Blog Talk Radio.
Well, your dadgum government, you saw so and so's. You got your damn hands in every pocket of my clothes. Well, your dadgum, dadgum, dadgum government. Oh, don't you know? Government, you better pay attention. You're setting up there like a fool's convention. Will you get down, get down, get down, government?
Well, welcome to Handling the Truth. This is Tenacity. Terry Dodd, and I'm here tonight with my co-host, Mike Getty, who will be joining us here in just a moment. And tonight's show is going to be very, very interesting. We're going to be talking about the election of 1800. It's going to be surprising to a few people, I believe, to see what went on back in 1800. But let's start the show out right, as we usually do, with a prayer. Almighty Father, we look around us and we just shake our heads at what we see and what's going on around us. And the lies that are being told, even though we know people are lying and they've been doing it for a long time, today it's still shocking without conscience how many lies are being fed to us through the media and through politicians. And Father, we just pray for truth. We pray that you expose the truth and that you shut down the liars and the tyrants. We know that they are your enemies as well as ours. Give us the courage to do what's necessary to serve your desire. But we pray for the United States, the people of the United States, not the government, because this government is so corrupt, Father. It would rightly go down. It would rightly change, and we would like to be agents of that change to make things better. So we ask you to work through Mike and me and our listeners, and just thank you so much for giving us a voice, an audience with you, and thank you for your Son that covers us with His righteousness, because it's only because of that that we have an opportunity to spend eternity with you. And we know that only you can sustain us. It's in the name of Yahshua HaMashiach, your Son, our Savior, our King, we pray. Amen. Well, good evening, Mike.
Hey, Terry. You've been a busy guy.
Oh, man. I'm not sure you have any idea. I had like three different groups show up on my doorstep. I knew some of them were coming, but they were supposed to be here a little bit earlier. So my apologies for being a little couple minutes late here getting the studio going. Well, Mike, I'm excited to learn a little bit more about this election of 1800. That's what you've shared with me privately is just it's almost comical, but it kind of beats any soap opera that I've ever heard of. So, where do you want to start?
Well, Terry, we look around at the crazy stuff that's happening with the election today, and the one that's coming up in less than a month, and we think about that and how stupid some of the things are around that. But this is not new in politics. This is business as usual in politics. And that is why I think the 1800 election, that election is so illustrative of that fact. But to understand the election of 1800, we have to go back to the Constitution of 1787 and realize that there were a group of people who called themselves Federalists, and they were not Federalists. They were monarchist or nationalist. And they wanted to create a government which they would run, which they would operate, which would give them a lot of powers that the Articles of Confederation didn't provide. So they were successful in getting that done and getting it ratified. And so then with the very first government under that Constitution was completely dominated by the Federalists who had created that Constitution. And, of course, the president was George Washington, and the vice president was John Adams. And the Supreme Court, the very first Supreme Court, was all Federalists. The federal judges were all Federalists that had been appointed by Washington. The Senate was dominated by Federalists 20-2, and the House of Representatives was 38 or 39-11, depending on which figure you look at. But it was overwhelmingly a Federalist government. There was no way that the opposition had very much of a voice at all, even though in the House of Representatives they did try with the Bill of Rights to push through the rights that the people had asked for, but they were dominated and shut down by the Federalists. So Alexander Hamilton is the Secretary of the Treasury. And Hamilton, and I think, Terry, with the letters that you and I have explored on this program and other programs, the letters between Washington, Jefferson, and Alexander Hamilton, with Jefferson being the Secretary of State, with those letters flowing back and forth, it becomes increasingly obvious, I believe, to anyone who is objective, that Alexander Hamilton was running the government. He was controlling the Congress with money, which Jefferson alluded to Washington. And Washington had to ask Hamilton about it, which indicates that Washington didn't know what Hamilton was doing either in those letters. So Hamilton was running things, and then things began to, with the First Bank of the U.S., you know, which I believe was an extension of the Bank of England and the Rothschilds. With that first bank, then things began to heat up. Then taxation began to happen. The sometimes oppressive taxation, in the fact that the people didn't have a lot of money. They didn't have much of anything. And then we end up with a whiskey tax. And then when Hamilton and Washington form a 13,000-man army to move into Pennsylvania to collect that whiskey tax, from the rural folks in Pennsylvania, and then the people who were arrested for that whiskey tax evasion were charged not with tax evasion, but were charged with treason. And Hamilton wanted them executed. People who would avoid paying taxes, Hamilton felt like they should be executed. So somewhere around 1791 to 1792, some of the things begin to unravel. First, there was a huge split between Alexander Hamilton and James Madison. And Madison, pardon me, who had been very much a leader of the Federalists, then kind of migrates over to the position of Thomas Jefferson. And, of course, they had been friends for years. And Madison begins to align himself more with Jefferson than with the Federalists. And then Jefferson becomes so disgusted with Hamilton and the way things are going, he resigns as Secretary of State and moves on back to Monticello. And so Washington initially did not want to run for a second term, but Jefferson basically talked him into staying because Jefferson was terrified that if Washington didn't run, that somehow Alexander Hamilton might become president, and which just petrified Jefferson to think of what might happen if that were true. So then, of course, you get to the second term of Washington, and things continue to spiral because of Hamilton. We end up with over 70% inflation. Things are not going that well. And then 1796, we end up with another election, and in that election, we have several candidates. One of the things that people have to understand, I think it is very critical, is that in those elections, there was no popular election. Not like today. The people didn't go to the polls and vote for whoever they wanted to be president. And the president and the vice president, even though there might be some alignment by party, there was no ticket that had the two of them together, like, you know, Biden and Harris, or there wasn't any such thing as that. So what happened, it depended on the states as to how they elected or how their electors, which we would call, you know, the college, electoral college today, how those people were picked varied from state to state. Some states held popular elections. Other states had electors were appointed by the state legislature. And in other states, the governor appointed the electors. So you had different ways. But anyway, the election was done by these electors. You know, technically, that's what we still have with the Electoral College, because regardless of the popular vote, the electors do not have to go with that popular vote in the states. And that's why there's a huge push for just a popular vote for the president. So in 96, we have Adams. We have Jefferson running for president. We have Aaron Burr running for president. And we have Charles Pinckney of South Carolina, who was a Federalist also. So they're running for president. Aaron Burr basically gets sold out by several of the people in the South because he was from New York. And so we end up with the president being John Adams and the vice president being Thomas Jefferson. So we move on. We get into the as things begin to get worse, then, of course, Hamilton, who believes that he should have been president instead of Adams, he leaves the administration, and then he begins to attack Adams, who is also a Federalist. So that becomes a huge point of contention. And it seems like wherever Hamilton went, he was always agitating against people. He was not a person who brought anyone together, but he felt like he should have been in control. So as things begin to spiral downward for the Federalists, more and more people begin to open newspapers and begin to talk against the administration, against the Federalists. And we're ending up in the late 1796, 1797, and the criticism is just rampant. Of course, Abigail Adams is very much upset that the people are blaming John Adams, her husband, for all of this. And the there is some evidence, but no way that one could say conclusively that it was her idea to come up with the Alien and Sedition Act, and especially she was worried about the criticism of John Adams, her husband. So the Alien Act was basically they wanted to extend the time that people who moved to the United States, they wanted to extend the time, and the Alien Act did that, extend the time that it took to become an American citizen. Because the Federalists were worried about the people who were migrating to the U.S. from France, and who were creating issues and against the Federalists. So we have that issue with the Alien Act. Then in the Sedition Act, what happened with the Sedition Act is they just simply said or passed a law, which the legislature passed, which, of course, it was heavily dominated by Federalists. Adams signs into law, and then the Supreme Court agrees with the Sedition Act. And the Sedition Act basically said it is against the law to say anything against the government or the people in the government. What happens is there is a member of the Congress who is a Jeffersonian, but he's from Vermont. He speaks out against Adams and his plan. So he is charged under the Sedition Act, and he is taken to trial. Well, these trials were an out-and-out farce, because if you read about these trials, it becomes absolutely amazing. Like Samuel Chase was a justice of the Supreme Court. And in those days, a justice of the Supreme Court had a district where they sat as a judge with the federal judge from that area. So if you had a trial, you had two judges. And in the trials of some of these people who were tried for sedition, you had the judge who would first charge the grand jury for an indictment, and the judge acted as the prosecutor. Even though there was a prosecutor also, the judge would basically, especially Samuel Chase, acted as a prosecutor. And then in one of the cases where the people became so frustrated, the defense attorneys became so frustrated, they walked out of the courtroom. Then Samuel Chase became the judge, the prosecutor, and the defense. The congressman was found guilty and sentenced to prison. And one of the strange fates in American history, while he was in prison, he was reelected to Congress. So the people back in Vermont realized what was going on. So it was a pure fiasco. And one of the things that was very instrumental, that when Salmon Chase was charging the jury in Callender's case, he openly said it makes no difference whether this law that they are charged under is constitutional or unconstitutional. You can't consider that. And it also doesn't make any difference if the what is alleged against the president or against the government is true or false. You cannot make a decision based on that. The only thing you can make a decision on is whether they criticize the government. And if they criticize the government, they're guilty. And all this did, Terry, was created more and more anger and more split between the Jeffersonians and the Federalists. So you have any questions so far?
No, you're doing great. I'm just learning here.
Okay, so then what happens is we're nearing the election, the end of Adams' first term, and we've got a split in the Federalist Party, and that split is, of course, between Hamilton and his followers and Adams and his people, who are also Federalists. And so Adams figures out that two members of his cabinet, the Secretary of State, which was Pickering, and the Secretary of War, who I don't remember his name right now, but he figured out that both of those people were sending information back to Hamilton, and they were associates of Hamilton. So Adams fires both of those two people from their positions, which further splits the Federalist Party. So then Jefferson is trying to put together his run for president again in 1800, and he goes to his friend Albert Gallatin, who is a member of the U.S. Congress, and he says, what do I need to do to possibly carry this race? Again, America was split along sectional lines. It was still North versus South. And people think that the war started over slavery, which is absolute ridiculous, because this thing had been going on since 1800, and prior, actually before that, because before that there had been an offer by two northern senators to John Taylor of Caroline to split the country in 1793. So the North and South had been against each other from the very beginning. And there were many things that happened that split the North and South, including the Jay Garducky Treaty, which we talked about last week. So when Jefferson goes to Gallatin and he says, okay, what do I need to do? Gallatin says the only thing that is really going to get you elected is to have a North-South coalition. So you need to find a person of your political philosophy in the North that has a strong following. So Jefferson, Gallatin recommends Aaron Burr. So Jefferson talks with Burr and says, and Burr says, yes, I'd be very much interested in running. Of course, again, we go back to the fact that you do not vote for tickets. But they knew at that time, even then, they were running sectional. And not only that, but the Federalist Adams decided on the same thing. So Adams decides that what he wants to do is to get Charles Coatsworth Pinckney from South Carolina to basically run with him and Burr and Jefferson, they decided to run together. Well, it was a very strategic pick to take Aaron Burr, because Aaron Burr was a very hard worker politically, and Burr had defeated Alexander Hamilton's father-in-law for senator in New York. And New York had a very strong anti-federalist leaning, which meant that the anti-federalists ended up basically being Jeffersonians in philosophy. So Burr worked very hard in New York to get delegates elected that would support Jefferson in the election. And actually, Burr works so well and does such a great job that he gets all 13 districts in the state of New York to support and vote for Jefferson. So then, of course, the person that hates Burr probably more than he hated anyone else was Alexander Hamilton. And, of course, we know how that eventually ended 4 years later. But Hamilton was just – he hated Burr because Burr had basically taken over the political leadership of New York from Hamilton. So Hamilton had lost his position in the federal government. He had lost his chance of being president in his mind. And now he was losing control of New York, and he was just absolutely beside himself, the fact that he was losing and diminishing his power, his political power, in this way. So, and again, to go back, he had split with Adams, so there was that part that was happening. So anyway, the election is held with five candidates actually ended up running. You had Jefferson, Burr, Adams, Charles Coatsworth Pinckney from South Carolina, and John Jay, who was governor of New York. But to go back a little bit, when New York, all 13 districts went for Jefferson, then the Federalists went to John Jay, whom was a Federalist also and had been the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and had given up that job to become the politician in New York. So what they asked governor, as a matter of fact, so what they asked John Jay to do was to discount the election of the delegates through the electoral process and for John Jay to kick out the results and to name all the electors in New York as Federalists. And Hamilton was behind that push, and he actually sent a letter to John Jay. And John Jay, actually, that letter's in the Library of Congress, and John Jay put at the bottom of the letter, to put it just the bottom line, he basically says, there's no way I could get by with this. The people have voiced their opinion. These are the electors we have. They're the electors we're going to have to live with. And even though Jay was, in effect, running for president also, he would not change those, which I give him credit for at least doing something right. So the election is just astounding, the way that the election turned out. You end up with 73 votes. Each one of the delegates voted for two people. So they had two votes for basically a vote for president and vice president, although it wasn't designated that way. So when the vote is finally taken, final results are in, and it took quite some time to get all those results in back then because some states were later, some states were behind the others. You had quite a few things going on. South Carolina was late. Kentucky was late getting in. So what you had was Jefferson had 73 votes. Aaron Burr had 73 votes. John Adams had 65 votes. Charles Coatsworth Pinckney had 64 votes. And Jay had one vote. So we had a tie election. which was at that time extremely disconcerting to both parties. Because then Alexander Hamilton goes to work and tries to get the Federalists to not participate in any form of the election from that point and to declare the election null and void because it was a tie election, which would leave the Federalists in power. There was even a move that would have switched it around and let Jefferson be president and Adams be vice president that was proposed because Hamilton was so afraid that Burr was going to win. And he was going to do and make any concession whatsoever to make sure that Burr was not elected president. So the vote goes, as I said, it was tied. So the vote goes to the House of Representatives. So then there are moves to get the Speaker of the House or the leader of the House, and this is might play out in this election in 2020. It goes into the House of Representatives, and so they try to get the House of Representatives to just declare a president without taking it to a vote. So there were all kind of political machinations taking place during that time frame. It was astounding, all of the different things and the different things that were going on. So anyway, they finally decide, hey, we're going to vote, and each state gets a vote. So each state has one vote. So the delegates in from that state, they all vote, and the winner in that state becomes the single vote for the state. There were 16 states at that time. So whoever was going to win needed a majority of 9 states to claim the victory. So they have the very first day meeting, and it was in February of 1801. The third sticks in my head for some reason. I don't hold me to that. But anyway, pardon me. So February, early February, 16 votes are held in one day by the Congress, House of Representatives, 16 votes, and they all turn out the same way. 8 states for Jefferson, 6 for 6 for Adams, and then there is 2 that were split to where there was no majority. So you had 14 states, and then you had 2 that had no majority. So they had this vote happens on multiple occasions, 16 times in one day. So then there's all kind of frustration. They're afraid, and then deals begin to be made. They're going back and forth, and, okay, let's do this, let's do that. And during this time, Burr becomes quite upset because the people that he had helped, Jefferson's people in Virginia, turned on Burr, and they were the ones who were willing to let Adams remain as vice president if Burr was totally out and Jefferson got to be president. They were willing to trade Burr for Adams. And so there was a lot of dissent immediately between the North and the South again. So you've got that split where the Southerners in Virginia didn't want this Northerner, this Yankee from New York, to be vice president. So they were willing to switch it out. Of course, I don't know how you win having Adams as a Yankee from Massachusetts. But anyway, that was kind of the deal. So you end up with a great deal of animosity again between Adams and the people in Virginia, because in the election of 1796, something similar had happened to take Burr out of contention. So then they meet again to vote again. So they vote a total, Terry, of 36 times. The House of Representatives votes. It's still a tie. And so then there's real frustration set in, because then the saying is that if we get to Inauguration Day, if we get to March the 4th, and we don't have a clear winner, we're just going to declare this a non-election, and we're going to continue with Adams as president. So there were even some Federalists who did not want this to happen. So after 36 times and ending up with a tie vote, I mean with the vote of 8-6, so then James Baird of Delaware comes to one of Jefferson's representatives, and Nicholas, and he comes to Nicholas and he says, look, here's what I will do. If you will get Jefferson to promise that he will strengthen the Navy and give my friend a job in the administration from Delaware, if you will keep him in his position as tax collector, and in those days, revenue collectors made more money than members of Congress. So that the revenue collector's position was a highly sought job. So Baird says to Nicholas, he says, look, if you will get Jefferson to agree to this, I will withhold my vote. And ironically, here we go. Baird is the only representative from Delaware. Delaware has one person who is an elector of the president, and that is Baird. And Baird says, well, very simply, I just won't vote. So that will be one less vote. I will just abstain from voting, which was permitted. So that would take one state out of the mix, and Baird tells Nicholas, if you will get Jefferson to do this, I am sure that at least two other states will follow my lead. So Nicholas tells Baird, I am almost sure I can get this done, but let me tell you, I cannot speak for Thomas Jefferson. So Baird was not comfortable with that. So Baird goes to a congressman from Maryland named Smith, last name Smith. He goes to him and he says, look, here is my deal. And so he offers him the same deal. Now, Smith comes back to Baird and tells Baird, yes, Jefferson agreed to this. So then Baird, they call for the next election. Baird does not vote for Delaware. And in two other states, the Federalists do not vote, which gives the Jeffersonians, or the Republicans as they call themselves, gives them the majority in those states. 37th vote ends up being Jefferson 10 states, Burr 4 states, and Adams and Pinckney are out. So it with a 10-4 vote, Jefferson becomes president and Aaron Burr becomes vice president. Then later, they found out that Smith, while he had talked to Jefferson, he went back to Baird, and he actually had no authority to go to Baird and say that Jefferson would make that deal. But that did not turn up until the election was over. So that is the position of how we ended up in the election of 1800. And, we should have, in the year 2000, that election of Burr v. Gore, that should never have gone to the Supreme Court, because the Constitution required that vote to go to the House of Representatives, which it did not. Now there is a lot of fear about this election coming up in 2020, because if they follow constitutionally and it ends up in a tie or a disputed race, it's supposed to go to the House of Representatives, and everybody is petrified, at least on the right political spectrum. Everyone is petrified that Nancy Pelosi might wield some kind of power in the selection process. So as contentious and as crazy as 1800 was, we're looking at the same thing in 2020. So any questions or thoughts, Terry?
Yeah, I'm curious. You know, these were Federalists that turned on Adams. Was it his radical monarchism, the Discourse of Davila that he put out, that was too far toward monarchy, even for the Federalist, or was it something else that caused some of these Federalists to turn against Adams?
Well, everything that I can discern, Terry, from all my reading is the fact that most of the Federalists wanted a monarchy anyway. The Federalists continually aligned themselves with England. And Adams had even threatened to go to war with France during that period of time, which would have supported England and supported the crown. And it's my contention, and I have, you know, no proof of this, but from everything I have read, I believe that the Federalists stayed with supporting England throughout because they were actually influenced by the money that came out of the Bank of England, you know, all the way back to the Constitutional Convention. And Hamilton left the Constitutional Convention five times to go talk to somebody in New York. And I still believe because of his financial gerrymandering, I still believe he was involved with someone that you don't want to talk about, or they didn't want to talk about when he went back and forth to New York. But what you had here was the political affiliation, I believe, more than philosophy. You had those Federalists who still clung closely to Hamilton. And you had that was the split, because you ended up with part of the party wanting to go this way, part of the party wanting to go that way. I mean, go back to 2016, we see the same thing in the Republican Party. Remember, the Bushes and others wanted to support Hillary. And there are now, we have the same thing. You've got certain Republicans that are claiming they'll support Biden. So I don't think it was the monarchy, although there was no question that John Adams wanted a monarchy. And there was no question that Hamilton wanted a monarchy. So you had both of them who were monarchists, because Hamilton made a pitch a monarchy on June the 17th of 1787 in a four-hour presentation to the Congress, and evidently people knew what he was about to do. They just didn't want him to, because it is in the official documented records that after Hamilton made this pitch, Madison said, uh-oh, Hamilton's let the cat out of the bag. So if Hamilton was pitching for a monarchy and Madison said he let the cat out of the bag, then someone else knew they were pushing a monarchy as well. So it becomes very intriguing, and like you said earlier, this is better than any soap opera.
Well, I'm still puzzled as to why they turned on him.
Well, the only thing I can tell you is that Hamilton never got along with anybody for too long. He was always writing against people. He wrote against Jefferson. He wrote against then he ended up writing against the people in his own party. He wrote against Burr constantly. He was always, you know, and a lot of people aren't aware that Hamilton, prior to the duel with Aaron Burr, had been either challenged or had challenged other people to a duel on 11 prior occasions. So this guy was always agitating people one way or the other. And he had even challenged James Monroe to a duel. And Monroe was a very quiet fellow who didn't say much, but he in the time he called Monroe a liar, Monroe jumped from his seat, according to the written reports, and became very fiery at Hamilton and challenged him to a duel at that point. So Hamilton's record of getting along people was never good, but he had used his money and his influence as Secretary of Treasury to buy an awful lot of support. And so I still think Hamilton was thinking that if he could divide the party somehow, that it was going to push him into a position of more power. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, I think so. It's my understanding that of those 11 prior duel challenges, in 10 of them, there was never a shot fired, because somebody, you know, there's always opportunity for an apology or some means of avoiding, you know, having to stand and face the fire coming out of the end of a musket. So,
well, that
this idea of this idea that they had all these duels, they had a lot of arguments, and they were going to have a duel, but that forced somebody to acquiesce.
Well, that is true, and that happened, as you said, in 10 of those instances. But the I think the thing that had happened with Burr is Burr had endured 7 years of this. And I think finally in 1804, even as Vice President of the United States, Burr had been pushed to the limit and could take the insults no longer from Hamilton. And so I think that was so progressive and building over such a long time that I believe that finally reached the point of no return with Burr. But of course,
well, and Hamilton's son had been killed. I think it's funny that they have like a special place at Weehawken or whatever it is at
Weehawken
in New Jersey. They'd go across the Hudson and because New York had outlawed dueling.
Right, that is correct. And yes, Hamilton's son had been involved in a duel as well. Of course, this
in 1801,
right? But if once you get into the actual study and not a you know, an idolatry piece like Ron Chernow did, that ended up being the play what the play was taken from on Hamilton. When you get into the actual discourse and look at the letters and everything that transpired about Hamilton, you know, how many people were aware that Hamilton went after Madison? As close as they had been in coming up with the Constitutional Convention, as hard as they had worked on that, within 2 years of the government getting started, Hamilton's going after Madison. So no one was sacred from Alexander Hamilton. He went after everyone. Anybody he viewed as competition or anyone who could limit his run for power became an enemy.
Well, this all points to Amy Coney Barrett's nomination, doesn't it?
Oh, excuse me, I was getting a drink. Yes, very much so. That too is, of course, you know, if it goes to the Supreme Court, where it never should have gone to start with, because, you know, the America was dead in my eyes in 2000 when the Supreme Court issued an order to the state of Florida to stop counting votes. Now, for any of you people who think your vote means anything, if the Supreme Court can tell any state to stop counting votes, your vote's worthless. And they did that in Florida. And, of course, everyone who was so glad to be rid of Clinton and to Gore as well, everyone was so happy that happened the way it did. They didn't care if the Constitution was violated or not. And I believe today we have the same atmosphere. There are people on either side of this political spectrum who wouldn't give one hoot in hell if they violated the Constitution as long as their person got elected.
Well, I'm not sure where to go from here, Mike. It's just fascinating to me, the correlation of what we're looking at today and what we saw in 1800.
Well,
we've seen basically all of this sort of stuff over the last 3 decades.
Exactly.
I mean, you could just about pick any one of these conflicts or insults or however you want it. It's almost disappointing that they've outlawed dueling. I got
that
a feeling.
True. Go ahead.
Just thinking, what Joe Biden would do if he was challenged to a duel. I think that coward would turn and run so fast it'd make your head spin.
Well, he couldn't run too fast. You know, he's no sprinter anymore, that's for sure. When I look at the fact that in 1796-97, when you look at what the Federalist had become to the point that the Congress, the President, and the Supreme Court were willing to totally destroy the First Amendment to protect their political future. In other words, we want to pass a law, the Sedition Act, to where we take away all of your rights of free speech, and you can't say anything about the opposition, even if it's true. And that is what Samuel Chase told the jury in the Callender case. I don't care if it's constitutional or unconstitutional. I don't care if it's true or false. The only thing you can make a decision on as a juror is, did someone criticize the government? You know, to look at
that,
the
is,
fact
that,
that
is
in,
that is so un-American. That is so un-American. I mean, that is just, that's disgusting, is what that is.
And the
lawyers that come out of these government-controlled law schools, they're all totally against nullification. It doesn't matter whether it's jury nullification or state nullification. The hair goes up on their backs when you mention it.
Right, because basically what you're saying is that we can say no. And people who own slaves don't want the slaves to ever have the ability to say no. And we are slaves in this country and have been for decades. It doesn't make any difference what size your cell is. If you can't get out of that cell and you have to pay for everything that happens with your labor or what have you, and you have no control over how your own money is spent, you are a slave. It's real simple, and people can't understand that. That is the thing that has always bothered me, is that we have become slaves. We became slaves in this country to a criminal government after the Civil War. And
it's interesting that Chase had preached about the people's right to judge the law prior to that case. He changed his whole tune. And I would,
right,
I would be remiss, and I think you would too. I mean, if Red Beckman's up in the clouds someplace looking down on us, he would not be happy if we didn't mention the fact that, you know, he was one of the people who inspired the Fully Informed Jury Association, and he spent a good amount of time teaching people that they had the right, not just the right, but the duty to judge the law, not just the facts of a case. The Bill of Rights, the situation in particularly the Seventh Amendment related to juries, is there to protect citizens or the people of the states. Pardon me for using the term citizens, but you know what I mean, the people of the states, to protect them against bad law. Not just because something's law doesn't mean it's good law. Sometimes it's bad law, and if you're like in taxation cases, income tax is unconstitutional as heck. It's a non-apportioned direct tax, and even the Supreme Court in 1895 declared the income tax to be unconstitutional because it was a direct non-apportioned tax. So the people in those cases, if you're on a jury, just because of the law, regardless of what the facts of the case are, you can acquit people because it's a bad law. And you have an obligation to do that. Only way you can get on a jury is by keeping your mouth shut and not letting them know that you understand what your rights really are. If they get any clue that you know what your rights are, and that you're going to nullify because it's a bad law, they will kick you off of that jury so fast. So anyway.
Well, I totally agree with that. No question in my mind. But it is remarkable that you point out the hypocrisy of Samuel Chase and the fact that he was, and this is one of the things that Jefferson tried to get him impeached for, was his actions in these cases where he sat as a judge but acted as a prosecutor. And the way he charged juries that was totally unconstitutional. And when Jefferson tried to get him impeached, the problem was that he still had so many Federalist supporters, which is politics. Politics will always champion over the Constitution. Politics will always champion over your rights. Politics will always be the ruling element. And history proves that over and over and over again. This, to me, it is so incredible that Chase said, look, he told the jury, if the legislature has passed this law, your representative that you voted for passed this law, so you have no say-so in how it is enforced. Now, that's a condensed version of what he told the jury. But the way he charged the juries in these sedition cases, the jury had no choice but to return a guilty verdict.
You know, we did a meet and greet here in Parker a few weeks back, and these verses at the beginning of Luke 12 just keep leaping out at me, and I'm just going to read the first four or five here. Meanwhile, when an innumerable crowd of people had gathered together, this is Joshua, this is our Messiah speaking, so that they trampled one another. Such a crowd, they trampled one another. He began to say to his Talmudim, or his disciples, first, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. And whatever is concealed shall be revealed, and whatever is hidden shall be known. So whatever you have said in the dark shall be heard in the light. And what you have spoken in the ear in inner rooms shall be proclaimed on the housetops. But I say to you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who kill the body and after that are unable to do any more.
Wow.
We got a lot of hypocrites in Washington, D.C., who perceive themselves to be sovereign and that they have the final say over the law. And if the people are educated, and like just you know the chapter and verse of where it talks about my people are lost for lack of knowledge. Boy, nothing could be more true.
Well, I think one of the men who was charged was James Callender. And so he offered a statement of what was at choice between Jefferson and Adams in the presidential election. He was one of the ones that was charged because a lot of this charge on sedition had actually been people writing in newspapers in support of Thomas Jefferson. So this supporting Jefferson was considered sedition. And so we see exactly that we are headed right back into the same place. And as Callender stated in his own trial, in his defense, he said, you will then take your choice between innocence and guilt, between freedom and slavery, between paradise and perdition. You will choose between the man who has deserted and reversed all of his principles, meaning Adam's, and that man whose own example strengthens all his laws. That man whose predictions, like those of Patrick Henry, have been converted into history. You will choose between that man whose life is unspotted by a crime and that man whose hands are reeking with the blood of the poor, friendless Connecticut sailor. I see the tear of indignation starting on our cheeks. You anticipate the name of John Adams. Every feature in the conduct of Mr. Adams forms a distinct and additional evidence that he was determined, at all events, to embroil this country in a war with France. Now, that is what he said, and he was charged for sedition for saying that. And Chase charged the jury and said, it makes no difference whether what he says is true or not. You can't judge his statement on truth. How can anyone ever make that statement to a jury? The truth does not matter. But to me, this part of history, to see exactly what the Federalists were pursuing, and this is what the Federalists wanted. They wanted this type of government, and when it got so bad that the people began to criticize it, then they wanted to shut the people up and they wanted to stifle all criticism. Now, does that sound like maybe Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union?
Sounds like Parker, Colorado to me.
Well,
I've witnessed the same thing. I've witnessed the same thing in right here in our local town. They've got a bully boy network of little small brain goons. That if you go on to any social media and try to bring out or question anything that their little clique voting block has been doing over the last 8 to 12 years in Parker, the goons come out against you with reactive behavior and create such a ruckus on social media that most people will walk away from the whole conversation because they're disgusted with it.
Well, you know, that ironically, Terry, that's exactly what happened in these trials in 1800. The trials happened the same way, and even the defense attorneys walked out because it was so corrupt, so terrible, that they saw there was no sense in staying, and then the judge becomes the defense attorney and assumes the rights of the defense. That, to me, is just all kind of incredible to even think about, but that's what they wanted.
Well, they make it painful to resist them. If it's not with that kind of reactive behavior that people, you know, just get disgusted and burned out on, they break people. They force them to expend their resources to the point of not being able to resist anymore.
Terry, you're exactly right, and that's all over Facebook, you know, and all over social media, tweets or whatever. If you come out with anything, there is a barrage of people sitting out there waiting to pounce. Which reminds me of the elements that were set up, and of course Professor Thomas DiLorenzo can speak to this very well, as he found out. If you write any publication against Lincoln or against FDR, there are legions of people set out there to immediately attack any work you do that tells the truth about FDR or Lincoln. And you just get pelted over and over and over and over again from all angles to discredit you in the eyes of the populace. And our problem with the populace of America today is they're dumber than a rock. And so they fall for the emotional attacks, which they think are cute. They fall for the emotional attacks and shy away from the truth over and over and over again. And, you know, I don't think, Terry, and I've said it on several occasions, I'll say it again, I do not think there's any hope for this country without divine intervention.
Well, I would agree with that. You know, you raise the issue in, you know, IM conversation with me about this political philosophy behind the Federalists. I don't know if you want to launch into that. We got about 23 minutes left tonight. But
well,
I
political
think
philosophy. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I make this statement, and I think if anyone will read the 24 essays of Samuel Bryan under the title Sentinel, and if you will examine what he writes in those 24 essays, he proves beyond the shadow of a doubt that the Federalists, as they call themselves, who were not Federalists, the Federalists worked in a criminal conspiracy to eliminate the government that had been created under the Articles of Confederation because it prohibited them from taxing the people to death to support their aristocratic desires. And when we talk about aristocrats and you think about those, think that the U.S. followed the same policy of Britain in the Revolutionary War, is our officers had to come in our military, had to come from the aristocratic class. And that went all the way into the Civil War, because the even in the South, you had to be from the aristocracy to be of a high rank in the military, which I believe led to the defeat of the South as well. There were so many incompetent generals who happened to be from the aristocracy. Braxton Bragg being one, and several others for that matter. Okay, ding, ding, ding. Sorry, I hit the wind chime. So the Federalists, according to Samuel Bryan, they needed to take over the government. They had tried repeatedly from 1781 to 1787 to get laws passed through the Articles of Confederation that would give them the power of unlimited taxation. And they had failed because of Article 13 of the Articles of Confederation said that every state had to agree to any piece of legislation. So they could not get it through because someone always foiled them in their attempt to open up unlimited taxation to pay for their socialist agenda. And, you know, you can say you don't like the word socialist, that's fine. But that's what it was. When the people end up paying for all of the escapades of the aristocratic class, that is socialism. So that the Federalists knew that they had to really couch, they said, but they had to create a constitution that would leave open the loopholes that would allow them to expand on that constitution. They said, and they even said in their letters between each other, let's make sure that we get this thing to where the people will accept it, and then we can add what we want. But we have to couch it in the terms that the population, the people will accept before we move forward. And well, the first thing they went to work on, once they had the constitution ratified, the first thing they went to work on in the first Congress was not a Bill of Rights, I promise you. The first thing they went to work on was the Judicial Act of 1789 to create all of these federal judgeships, which would give them authority to strike down any state law that came up that countermanded their goals. I know people would love to say, they would love to get on the David Barton train and say, oh, all of our founders were wonderful Christians. Well, that's a lie. But they would love to say that because it feels good, Terry. It's something you can sleep with. You know, oh, wow, this feels so good. I'm comfortable. The truth is not comfortable when it comes to this history, I promise you. And when Alexander
Hamilton, I think you just described the cause of red, white, and blue fever.
Oh, exactly. And when you had Alexander Hamilton, who was sitting there, and he was becoming so frustrated because he had been sitting there through the end of May, he had been sitting there through June, and they, you know, he had been there a month, and they just weren't moving fast enough to get the monarchy that he wanted. So on June the 17th, he had finally had all he could take, and so he jumps up and he proposes the monarchy, a complete and total monarchy. And he says, here is what I want. Here is, we want a president for life. We want this president to be able to appoint all of the governors in every state for life. We want one elected branch, which will basically be the House of Representatives, but the president can overrule and veto anything they ever do. So that is what he proposed, people. That is what he wanted. And then James Madison says, oh, no, in frustration, he says, oh, no, Hamilton's let the cat out of the bag. That's very telling. To me, that says that Madison knew what they were after. And then the Federalists jumped in very quickly after Hamilton becomes so upset that he can't get what he wants out of the gate. That then they come up and they start all of this, we don't really want to do that. We don't really totally want to eliminate the states. They had to get back. They had to go into recovery mode. They had to get it back. They had to recover it to get what they wanted. And so shortly after that, they had to get it through. And then the very first thing they put through, the Judicial Act of 1789, amends the Constitution, Article 3, and no one says a word because the Federalists control the government. The voice of opposition might have been there, but it was a small squeak because the Anti-Federalists did not have enough people. They were outnumbered in the Senate 20-2. What chance did they have? They were outnumbered 3-1, over 3-1 in the House of Representatives. The Supreme Court and the judges were all Federalists. The president was a Federalist. The vice president was a Federalist. They had no chance. So you had a monarchy whether you wanted it or not, because they were going to do whatever they wanted to do. And this monarchy came down in 1796-97 to this Alien and Sedition Act, to where they were going to gather complete control of the government, and you couldn't even say anything about it. You could not say, hey, no, you couldn't say anything negative about the government. If you did, you went to prison. And if you had a trial, then the judge was going to tell the jury that it didn't make any difference whether it was constitutional or unconstitutional. It didn't make any difference whether what you said was a truth or a lie. You got convicted anyway.
So much for the First Amendment.
Yeah, and it went away. They just totally disregarded the First Amendment. And they were willing to do that to accomplish political purposes. And there's no difference today. I promise you there is not a person in Washington who gives a hoot in hell about the Constitution. They're there for power and money. And the Constitution makes no difference. As a matter of fact, most of them couldn't tell you anything about the Constitution. Remember when Nancy Pelosi got so upset when they asked her if something was constitutional one time? And then when de Blasio was asked, well, what do you think about Article 1 of the Constitution? And he said, oh, you mean free speech. Didn't say Amendment 1, said Article 1. They have no clue about the Constitution. If you think that is false, get a member of government to sit down in public and take a quiz on the Constitution. See if any of them will show up. Invite them to show up for a quiz on the Constitution. It's election season. That's what the question that should be asked. Because that's what
this
take
is. This is a major reason. I found that this is a major reason why so many of them rely upon legislative counsel to make a decision on any vote. And that legislative counsel gives them unlawful advice.
Absolutely. And this is where one of the things that just absolutely fries me is when they start talking about these Supreme Court justices and they start talking about original intent, which the Republicans think is the Holy Grail. Well, we need an originalist on the court. Well, what did the originalists who wrote the Constitution were monarchists. So is that what you want? You want someone who's going to interpret the Constitution in the favor of monarchy? System is so failed, Terry. I'm totally surprised it's lasted as long as it has.
Well, how do we make change without blood in the streets?
At this point, I don't think it's possible. I'll be honest with you. I do not think without divine intervention. And tomorrow, of course, you're familiar with Scorpio and Giuseppe and I tomorrow on Dare to Think Out Loud are going to discuss the various scenarios, what we think may happen after November 3rd. And there are several scenarios, and none of them are good, my friend, I promise you.
Well, that's in the morning, right?
Yeah, well, actually, it's from noon until 2 p.m. Eastern. I do not see, I don't know how we get out of this election without blood in the streets. I just do not see how it happens because everything has been set up. It's been laid, the groundwork is there. When they agreed to this postal thing, they set up everything for fraud. And just to give you a really good example of that, in an email a few days ago, I haven't lived in New Mexico in 15 years. In an email the other day, I got an offer to send an address, and New Mexico would send me an absentee ballot. And I thought it was some kind of trick. And so I actually responded to the email, and it's not a trick. So what is going to happen when there is no way that either side is not going to be able to say after November the 3rd that there was fraud in this election, because there's going to be fraud on both sides. And I believe that was intended. This mail thing is a fiasco. It's a total fiasco. And one of the things I remember in the good state of Colorado there in the county where I was in 2014, they ended up in 2014, which was a non-presidential election. They had a very contentious race for the sheriff, and for the first time in history, they had more people vote in a off-year election than voted in the presidential election of 2012. So, which is totally unheard of. 4,000 more people voted in a county than voted in the presidential election. And then in 2016, when Colorado was doing the mail-out ballots, there were people who got three or four ballots in the mail with different configurations of their name. First name, middle initial, last name. They got all kind of configurations. All of these discrepancies
are
taken.
What county was that in?
Montezuma. And after all of these discrepancies were found, they were taken to the Secretary of State of Colorado, and they said, we will look into it, and no one has heard a word since. Think about what happened to Red in Montana.
Was that when Williams was Secretary of State?
I think so. I'm not sure who it was. I know the people who actually took the discrepancies and said, when in the Dickens has anybody, when have you ever had more people vote, 4,000 more people? The county had 25,000 people in it. You had 4,000 more people vote in 2014 than voted in 2012. How does that happen?
Well, the probability against it is huge. I would almost find it impossible rather than improbable.
Well, then in 2016, when you get people, and one of the gentlemen that who was a school teacher at the high school brought me his ballots because we were talking about it. And he said, look at this. How could I get four ballots? How could I get a ballot with my first name, my middle initial, my last name, another ballot with my first initial, my middle name, my last name, and another ballot with my middle initial, I mean, with my first name, my middle name, and a ballot, last name, and then I get a ballot with my first initial, middle initial, last name, and a ballot. He got four ballots in the mail for the 2016 election. Now, to me, that told the story. Absolutely told the story of what they did. They created different variations of names to increase the outcome by 4,000 votes in 2014. But nobody cares, Terry.
Well, I want to put you on the spot just a little bit. Not a lot, just a little bit.
Do it.
You've been at the heart of the intelligence community in the past. What percentage of those in the intelligence community would you say were infiltrators of the globalist banksters who were behind the Federalists and are behind the establishment today? What percentage in that community would you say are infiltrators of that group?
Percentage is going to be hard to say, Terry. The thing I will tell you is that they are, all of those people are in positions of high authority. So you can have a person in a position of high authority, and you can have 8, 10, 20 people down here busting their butts to do a good job. But stop and think about what happened in the FBI right before 9/11. When there's good FBI agents were coming up with all of this information about these people taking flight lessons that had no clue whatsoever about it, and that information gets sifted through the FBI, and the FBI shuts down the investigation. So it doesn't take a high percentage of people to shut these investigations down. It's where they're positioned that makes all of the difference, because I know I worked with some people who truly, truly, truly love this country and were very much concerned about its well-being and to protect it from not only internal but external, foreign and domestic enemies, people who really, truly cared. But I saw them shut down at several turns. I saw people get disgusted and leave and quit because of that. And then you ended up with some folks, and I could name those, and I'll be happy to do that privately, but I can show you files of people who left the National Security Agency and in protest and talked to some people in the media, and whoopee-dee, you want to talk about being charged with treason and violating the Sedition Act of 17? Oh, man, you do not get, you know, and these were good people. Terry, these were, you know, some of them were case managers, and they tried. I mean, let's look at the CIA. Look at how the CIA has overstepped, totally overstepped its mandate, its charter. the CIA was Central Intelligence Agency. The Central Intelligence Agency was designed in 1947 in the National Defense Act to only collect information from the other agencies and to put it into a central clearinghouse. They were never authorized to go out on their covert missions that they perform. They were prohibited from doing anything within the borders of the United States. And if we think that's true, we've lost our mind.
Wow. Well, I appreciate your answer. I recognize that what you're saying, I certainly believe exactly what you said. It's just that when you look at the pervasiveness throughout all of government on the infiltration, it's just mind-boggling how it can ever be overcome.
Well, stop and think about what the CIA testified to under Operation Mockingbird. One of the officials, the top official for the CIA, said, "We don't need people throughout the media as our employees. All we need are people at the management level." So that's what's happened to the journal. There is no journalism anymore, because if you write a story that reveals government corruption and you take it into your editor, they're going to say, no, it's not going to be done. I have seen that firsthand with people that I knew that tried to get things through in journalism, and it's no, I'm not, there's no way that'll be printed. You can't, you know, so the journalists learn that, hey, you print what they want you to print or you don't have a job anymore. It's controlled.
Well, and censorship, is having a real impact on the independent journalists by demonetizing them and taking them out of the search engines.
Oh, yes. And that
so,
is...
happening. It's happening even with independent journalism.
Well, Terry, I wrote an article about this called Comfortable Patriotism, where I said, look at the people in alternative media and everything else. Look at the ones that are getting independently wealthy, and you know who are bought and paid for. Because if you publish the truth in this country, you are not going to make any money. And when people like Drudge begin and they start to make an inroads into the system, they get bought out and they're owned, but they become fantastically wealthy. And as soon as the wealth...
even from foreign interest.
Right. As soon as the wealth starts pouring in, the truth goes away. Truth and money do not match, I promise you.
You know, who's a stockholder in News Corp?
Yeah, imagine that.
Who's owns the stock of Drudge now? But
right.
You look at some others who are extremely highly paid, and I'm gonna step on holy ground now. But you look at the Rush Limbaughs and the Sean Hannitys.
Well, somebody please tell me how what Rush Limbaugh does for 3 hours a day is worth $1 million a week. That's what his salary is. How in the world is a man working 3 hours a week, basically parroting the government line, worth $3 million? I mean, $1 million a week. How is that even possible? And I'll go so far, I'll step on another toe for you here, too, Alex Jones.
Well, that's... We've known that he was controlled opposition for a long time. Anybody that's not willing to go after the banksters, you know, only when he was cornered would he act like he was on the right side of things with regard to the banksters.
Well, I was talking with a gentleman today, and we had just gotten to know each other not too long ago. He's a neighbor. And we were talking, and He believes this COVID nonsense, and I was telling him that I do not, and he said, why not? And I said, if you were to be held and charged with a crime, would you want to go in and the only thing the jury got to hear was the prosecution?
And we're out of said, time, Mike. What?
Okay, buddy. Go ahead.
Close
it's been a wonderful
close it out
experience. Thank you.
Close it out for us.
Well, I just can't
good night, everyone.
We are
the time snuck up on us. So we'll see you next Thursday night with Handling the Truth. Check out my daddy show on Sunday evening on Revolution Radio called Addicted to Your Own Destruction. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
No good sense of a shoe fitting fire starting. Ought to tell you no good preambulatory bone frame and nail it to your government walls. All of you, you dadgum government, you sorry so and so's. You got your damn hands in every pocket of my clothes. Will you dadgum, dadgum, dadgum government? Sometimes